Spotlight, we'll look at how flawed info such as this led to the U.S., Britain, and France launching bombing raids in Syria. Did they use flawed intel or fake news to continue the war in Syria?
UK's national broadcaster, the BBC, has admitted that its documentary on an alleged 2018 chemical weapon attack in the Syrian city of Douma contained serious inaccuracies. The program reported that the former inspector with the International Chemical Weapons Watchdog had expressed doubts over the organization's stance on the incident. The watchdog, in its probe into the incident, had blamed it on the Syrian government, a charge Damascus denied. The BBC program claimed the inspector was motivated to go public about his doubts in return for getting financial reward from the whistleblowing website WikiLeaks. Now, the British Broadcasting Corporation has accepted that it had no evidence to back up that claim. Also, WikiLeaks has said such a reward was never paid.
The excuse of chemical weapons was used in Syria again and again. In 2012, 2013, it was used for the sanctions on Syria. It was used for the U.S. beginning military actions. The latest exposé in Douma in 2018 was at a time when every report said Syria was clearly winning the war. And that was why this massive new level of bombardment, happened. They just found a new story. All of the media used it. Hundreds and hundreds of news articles from every direction screamed about it. And now we find it's just a fabrication.
It's surprisingly rare for the BBC to rule against itself. The recent confession is hailed as a major victory for truth.
Let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. We have activist, historian, and investigative journalist, who is a former BBC employee, Tony Gosselin, joining us from Bristol. Also joining us, journalist and political analyst John Bosnich, who joins us from Belgrade.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
I'd like to welcome you both, and I'm going to start with you, Tony Gosling, if I may. Tell us what has happened here. You have an incident that happened in 2018, briefly, if you can touch on that for us, and why you think that at this point you have the BBC coming out saying what it's saying in terms of inaccuracies, etc.
So this whole idea of faking weapons of mass destruction attacks is really, this incident in Douma in 2018, this time a chemical weapon attack, supposedly by the President Assad's government, which actually wasn't. I mean, it was all faked. It's very reminiscent, isn't it, of the fake weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, which was used as the excuse to go in there in 2003 into that illegal war. And basically, we've got a similar situation here, at least an attempt to do the same in Syria, with all these missile strikes that were launched by the French, the British, and the Americans straight after this fake news attack, weapons of mass destruction, back in 2018. Also, outside international law. So really, what we seem to be dealing with here is a bunch of international criminals who want to try to break international law by attacking countries, and then persuading their own domestic populations here in the West, using the mass media, that this is all fine and okay, because certain individual, you know, whether it's Saddam or President Assad, has been using WMD against their own people. Now, you know, the same, of course, was used against Colonel Gaddafi, saying that he was attacking his own people, and that was used as an excuse to attack Libya. So this is really, history repeating itself with the criminals in the West trying to get these wars started. Now, you know, what was the purpose of all of this? Well, it seems to be following the Yinon plan. He was an Israeli general, and he was saying that we need to have all these various attacks on Middle Eastern countries in order to destabilize the Middle East, to balkanize the Middle East. But I think at the end of the day, you know, you could also look upon this as just resource grabs, the attempt of the West with a massive military that it can't really justify to its own population, sitting around. They don't want them twiddling their thumbs, so they want to involve them in invasions. And these media operations are the Trojan horse in the mind of the Western public, which allows them to just get away with criminal acts. And so that's why this is so important. And Peter Hitchens, who's put this complaint into the BBC, myself, I complain to the BBC from time to time. I never hear anything in the national press about it, because Peter Hitchens has got a column in the Daily Mail and the Mail on Sunday. They know that they can't just get away with fudging it. It's journalists like me, real investigative journalists like me, who find that because we don't have much of an outlet, obviously I do here on Press TV, but Press TV is banned in the UK, that we find that that those sorts of complaints to the BBC generally get sidelined or ignored, but they realise they cannot ignore Peter Hitchens' complaint on this occasion. And the big problem with this documentary on the radio, first of all, Chloe Hadjamajul, I mean, can't even pronounce her surname. In the world of journalism in Britain, nobody's ever heard of this woman. She's come out of nowhere to produce this fake news report. But right. What she's been doing is an actual, you know, it's well known in journalism as a line that you should never cross. That is, she has put words into the mouth of her source from the OPCW.
Okay.
And that's really the crux of this complaint, is that the Alex, this guy from the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, actually never said what she said he said. So it is fake news, and the worst thing about this particular type of fake news is this is an excuse to start a war. So that's why it's such an important complaint, and well done for Peter Hitchens and the Mail on Sunday for pointing the finger at the BBC as the propagandists they are, and warmongers too, also sure. Trying to include WikiLeaks as part of the scam that they're trying to run. So attacking sure. Real journalists, propagandists attacking the real journalists in Britain.
Right. Well, you mentioned a lot of things there. We're going to get into some of the WikiLeaks stuff and other points that you made there, Tony Gosling. But John Bosnich, I'd like to get this straight, because it's confusing, and I'm sure the viewer wants to know this. When you have something like this happen, a documentary being made, and there to be inaccuracies, as the BBC has confessed, it's not as if the person making the documentary just decided on his or her own initiative to include fictional pieces in there. There must have been some directives there. So you got that on the one hand, I'm guessing. And on the other hand, I'm wondering if this is actually happening within the military ranks of the people making decisions, whether they're getting faulty information, whether intended or not. So if you can paint that picture for us.
First of all, I'd like to congratulate my fellow real journalist for his comments preceding mine, because he's covered all of the key touch points in this story. That's the first point. Secondly, I can share with you my own experience as a war reporter, having covered military conflicts for approximately one decade in various countries. I can tell you that any time that the military-industrial complex of a country can provoke a conflict through the lying mainstream media, and there's a reason why that expression exists, whenever they can do that, it pays very, very well to do so. It not only sells weapons, it continues the basic system of war as the first response. There's no need for an inquiry. There's no need for an investigation, because the media monopolies in the Western warmonger countries, and I'm sorry to say that because I was born in one and grew up in one of those countries in Canada, but those countries are led by an elite which is responsible to no one. They simultaneously control the military-industrial complex, and they buy up the media through the resources of the military-industrial complex. So what the military-industrial complex does is it provokes incidents. It creates scenarios by which incidents could take place. It hands those scenarios over to its intelligence services like the CIA. As in the case, we can give many instances over the years, but you know, Adolf Hitler used a fake news story about Poland invading Germany in order to start his war on Poland. We know that the Americans used the fake Gulf of Tonkin incident to provoke their entry and their further activity in Vietnam. We know for a fact, I was actually there as a reporter on the scene, that the so-called Račak incident, which was reported as a Serbian massacre in Kosovo, was faked, and we know that it was promoted and called a massacre by the CIA agent operating in Kosovo on behalf of America. So this is not a new tactic. In fact, I would have to say this is the oldest tactic in the book. And the fact that the military-industrial complex is able to so easily infiltrate the media, and that's what they do. They infiltrate the media. There are honest journalists in the media, but they do not control the means of publication. They submit stories, the editors accept or reject the stories, and the stories go forward. When the editors and the publishers get an order from their secret intelligence services telling them that a story needs to be placed, they place it, or they're replaced. That's how the media works in this current system. The media is not responsible to the people, and when the military uses a media fake news, and I want to go further than fake news, because fake news can be intentionally fake, or it can just be fake through incompetence. Mm-hmm. These incidents are always intentional. They are pre-planned conspiracies to use the media to allow a freedom of hand, a freedom to make war that is not constitutionally available in the countries that make those wars.
Sure.
And that is the main thing that's happening here.
Tony Gosling, this has been a rehash in the past, and that is the role that the OPCW played in this whole alleged chemical attacks, accusing the Syrian government and Russian forces, perhaps, of executing it. And if you can tell us the role that the OPCW played, because there have been obviously allegations made here against them that they have sidestepped concerns about the controversial investigation into that attack, and even accusing the body of accepting unsubstantiated or possibly to have manipulated findings. Do you see the OPCW to be guilty of that?
Well, look, the OPCW is what I would call a point of struggle. It's one of those international organizations which is absolutely critical to stopping this kind of attack, but it's an organization which is very much in the crosshairs of the Western military. They want to control that organization because they know that if they can get them to make statements, I mean, we've seen, for example, the way the International Olympic Committee, as another international body, has been used as a stick with which to beat Russia over doping. All countries pretty much use doping, but Russia was singled out for that purpose because it's part of the Operation Beluga, which is a Western NATO intelligence service operation in order to discredit Putin and discredit Russia in the Western press. So, you know, that's the sort of thing that is going on in the OPCW. But I'd like to also point to the specific organization, the White Helmets, which was used in this. documentary. They, the boss of those, supposedly committed suicide, although it looks very clear, if you look at the evidence, that the money for the White Helmets was coming through British intelligence, through MI6, and that this was really just an intelligence front. So what the British intelligence were doing was they created a so-called humanitarian organisation equipped with video cameras to go out there and actually to work for British intelligence, to deliver stories to the British mainstream news night after night, which would be favourable to the British view that there needed to be regime change in Syria. So this was a propaganda attempt, and this is the information that was picked up partly in this documentary. But more importantly, I just like to explain to your viewers how it works here in Britain, that a so-called independent media, state-run media, like the BBC and others, of course, can report in such a biased way a complete fake news story designed to start a war. And that is because we have a unit in Britain called the 77th Brigade, which is a psychological warfare, what they call information operations brigade. It's a rather large army formation put together for psychological warfare purposes. And whilst their own serving members in that brigade and in those offices putting all sorts of fake news out in the mass media and elsewhere and actually on the internet, the idea is also to get people sharing these memes up on social media, is that there are quite a number of retired army officers who are now working within the mainstream press. So, you know, this has happened over the last 50, 60 years, quite a lot of, for example, from World War II, officers from the forces then went in the 1950s, 60s and 70s to work in the media in Britain. But they are reservists still for the army, and they're working within the media here in the West. And what happens is they get a phone call from the 77th Brigade, hey, we got a great exclusive for you here, and there it goes straight into a news bulletin, or a documentary gets commissioned based on what is effectively an army intelligence operation, a military operation, in order to get whatever story it is they want out there. And that, of course, can be a casus belli for a new war. And the idea is really to hoodwink the British public, hoodwink the Western public for long enough, as long as it takes to commit the crime to get the war started. Sure. And the 77th Brigade have no such oversight such as the BBC have. So I think that the next step really needs to be to get the 77th Brigade to explain its role in this fake news that was also a war crime.
Are the officials known? Are they known to give interviews? Can you make a request? I'm just asking if that's possible or not.
Well, you can make a request, but the idea that they're going to fess up, put their hands up and say, yes, it was us. We used our army officers within the media in order to plant this story. I'm afraid you're going to get nowhere with that sort of request.
Here's the math here, John Bosnich. I was surprised at this. Again, this since it's somewhat dated. You have 20 unresolved issues in Syria's chemical weapons file, of declarations that have been made. You have the UN and the OPCW. They have officially attributed 8 of those chemical weapons attacks to the Syrian regime, as they say. So you got 20, 8 of them is towards the Syrian regime. That leaves, 12 that the terrorists have done. So when you take a look at the math there,
even if
and how that's obviously much greater than the 8, if the Syrian government is actually did execute it, it's a huge question mark and a huge doubt on the Syrian government, because to this day we still have these Daesh terrorists say there's going to be a chemical attack. Russia makes that announcement. Give us your feedback on just this particular piece of stat.
Okay, of the 20 that you're referring to, I would guess, everything starts with a guess that you have to check, but I would guess that 0 were committed by the Syrian government. Why? Why do I guess that? Because before you analyze, and I worked as a journalist and a government advisor in Canada and in Japan. First, you have to analyze the basic news story and ask yourself, who would benefit from this news? Obviously, the main beneficiaries of any news that Syria is doing anything illegal are the Western NATO powers that were trying to topple illegally by force of arms the government of Syria. So, once we see a news story that only can possibly benefit the opponents of the Syrian government, we have to look at that news story with deep suspicion, because a balanced news story will quote the government in detail, and it will quote the accusers in detail. And if you check the BBC and you check CNN, you will find that as a general rule, they give 10 times, that's a real figure, 10 times more information against the, and they use the word regime. They don't refer to the Syrian government. So that's a telltale signal right away. The minute you see a report from Western media that refers to the regime of Syria, or the regime of Donbass, or the regime of some place, you know that you're reading a biased report, especially when it refers to English government sources, in the same sentence in which it refers to Syrian government sources as Syrian regime sources. So a cursory glance at a news report will usually tell you whether it's propaganda or not. Then as you go past these first telltale signs, which are always there, then you look to see if they use a resort to authority. So BBC will republish information from Germany, or they will republish information from the CNN, and CNN will republish information from Germany and BBC, and so on, so that they pretend to say, our fellow independent journalists have reported this. And that's always false. Mm-hmm. As a general rule, that's always false.
Okay.
So we've got something that is not just false by accident, it's false by design. And when something is false by design, it should be investigated immediately. And any military action to follow a press report has to be followed first by a public inquiry. Because this carte blanche is the way wars are started, and this is the way millions of people are killed.
Exactly.
Not dozens.
And that brings me to my last question. Tony Gosselin, something's got to be done. I mean, to carry some placards by some people saying, you know, stop lying or stop this propaganda is not going to be enough, I'm guessing. Because we're looking at a world where there are threats being made. There are threats being made against the Islamic Republic by the U.S., and we know how the U.S. and the U.K. work together. The U.S. focus
damages
on China.
Lawsuits.
Excuse me?
I'm sorry to interrupt here, but I think that the proper recourse is to at least sue the BBC for the damages incurred as a result of its false report on the ground in Syria in the world court. That means tens of millions of dollars of damage, not counting the lives lost.
That sounds like a good idea, even maybe more so. If you can tell us, Tony Gosselin, what more can be done? Again, we're looking at a world where it's filled with military thoughts, and it's, you know, a lot of it is coming from the U.S., the focus on China, the threats being made against Iran. Biden just last week used the word options when Naftali Bennett visited him. So what can be done to prevent this, at least for the general public to be aware and to comb their psyche so that they don't fall to the trap of the media like it happened with the BBC doc?
Well, look, it's a very difficult question to answer what can be done, because the deep state has a great deal of clout and control of the media, as well as, of course, much of the parliament here in the UK, for example. I think what is a fascinating little smoking gun in this crooked fake news documentary the BBC put out trying to smear Assad is the way they also trying to smear Julian Assange and WikiLeaks in the same report, because as many people know, Julian Assange is on the record as explaining absolutely right and factually that the only way that wars can start is through lies. And he saw it as his life's mission as an investigative journalist, probably one of the most important publishers on the planet, to scotch those lies. And it's no accident that he is now in jail here in Britain, actually, even though he hasn't actually committed any offence here in the UK. So I think one of the ways we could do something to stop this is to force, through legal means or whatever, I don't know how you're going to do it, okay. But to get Jill and Assange
Sorry,
out,
I got to jump in. I do apologize, Tony Gosselin. We're just fresh out of time. But thank you. Some great comments there made by Tony Gosselin, activist, historian, investigative journalist, and a former BBC employee. And thank you so much, John Bosnich, journalist and political analyst. Wish we had more time. And that does it for this edition of The Spotlight.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in from Ikara Tafwe. It's goodbye.
Oh, Hussein, Imam Hussein. Oh, Hussein, Imam Hussein. Ya Mawla, Mawla, Ya Mawla, Mawla, Ya Mawla, Mawla, Ya Mawla. Oh, Hussein, Imam Hussein.
I was sitting in my room with a thought on my mind that how grateful we are to have you, oh Hussein.
Insight into the Holy Quran.
And I thank you, Allah. I thank you, Allah. I thank you, Allah. I thank you, Allah.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين. ثم الصلاة والسلام على محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're going to be with you with another edition of Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we are trying to talk about the different verses of the Holy Quran, which are thematically connected to our topic, which is Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. So stay with us, and let's listen to some of the verses.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
وَقَرْنَ فِي بُيُوتِكُنَّ وَلَا تَبَرَّجْنَ تَبَرُّجَ الْجَاهِلِيَّةِ الْأُولَى وَأَقِمْنَ الصَّلَاةَ وَآتِينَ الزَّكَاةَ وَأَطِعْنَ اللَّهَ وَرَسُولَهُ إِنَّمَا يُرِيدُ اللَّهُ لِيُذْهِبَ عَنْكُمُ الرِّجْسَ أَهْلَ الْبَيْتِ وَيُطَهِّرَكُمْ تَطْهِيرًا.
And abide in your houses, and do not display yourselves as was the display of the former times of ignorance. And establish prayer, and give zakah, and obey Allah and His Messenger. Allah intends only to remove from you the impurity of sin, O people of the Prophet's household, and to purify you with extensive purification.
Brothers and sisters, in the previous programs, we have talked about the different aspects of infallibility and ismah. The point is that Imam Hussein, as well as all the other Ahlul Bayt and infallible Imams, have reached the stage of infallibility and thus have become Almighty Allah's favorite. Ahlul Bayt, being purified from uncleanness and being endowed with good qualities, is the reason for their being Allah's favorites. In the Holy Quran, Allah has praised them with their best quality, which is a thorough purification and their access to the hidden truth. لا يمسه إلا المطهرون, the Holy Quran says. None shall touch it save the purified souls. And due to their knowing of the hidden truth, Ahlul Bayt are aware of the whole universe and act in accordance with the divine decrees and the best deeds. These features show that the devoted ones have been trained and chosen directly by Allah. Self-purification, awareness of the hidden truths, and realization of Allah's commands have made the Ahlul Bayt Allah's favorites. وَيُحِبُّ الْمُتَطَهِّرِينَ, and He loves those who purify themselves. The fact that Imam Hussein alayhi salam knew what was going to happen to him in the plain of Karbala can also be explained by this fact. So Ahlul Bayt's morality is a manifestation of their self-purification. Such morality like justice, reliance on Allah, patience, faith, and certainty and repentance have made Ahlul Bayt Allah's most favorites. In Allah yuhibbu at-tawwabin, surely Allah loves those who turn to Him much. Now let's have a look at one of the traditions. Salama has reported that one day Allah's messenger was sitting at home. Fatima brought a small pot with dish of flour in it. Allah's messenger asked, "Where is Ali and his two sons?" Fatima answered, "They are at home." He said, "Tell them to come here." After some time, Ali, Hassan and Hussein and Fatima were walking toward Allah's messenger. As soon as he saw them, he took his cloak and covered them with it, saying, "Allahumma ha'ula'i ahlu bayti fa'adhib anhum ar-rijsa wa tahhirhum tathira." They are my household, O Allah, and my favorite ones, so remove wickedness from them and make them pure, a thorough purification. And at this time, this verse of the Holy Quran was revealed, the verse of purification.
O people, compete with each other in attaining noble traits, and hasten to acquire lofty benefits, and do not count those good deeds which you have delayed.
Imam Ali alayhi salam has said, "Ata rajulun ila an-nabi faqal, ya Rasulullah, ayyul khalqi ahabbu ilayk?" A man came to Allah's messenger saying, "O Allah's messenger, who is your most favorite one?" The Holy Prophet said, "هذا وابناه وأمهما." This, he meant Ali, his two sons and their mother are, "هم مني وأنا منهم." They are from me and I am from them. وهم معي في الجنة هكذا وجمع بين إصبعيه. They are from me and I am from them, and in paradise they will be as close as two fingers to me. So, brothers and sisters, as we have mentioned many times before, if we wish to be Almighty Allah's favorite, we must endeavor to purify ourselves, both internally and externally. But the fact is, by obeying Him, we have to reach this stage. Imam Hussein alayhi salam could not be Imam Hussein except without truly and completely obeying the orders of Almighty Allah and His Prophet. And we have to do so. We have to obey Him. We have to obey His Prophet and the Ahlul Bayt. That's why the Holy Quran says, "قُلْ إِن كُنْتُمْ تُحِبُّونَ اللَّهَ فَاتَّبِعُونِي يُحْبِبْكُمُ اللَّهُ وَيَغْفِرْ لَكُمْ ذُنُوبَكُمْ." Say, if you love Allah, then follow me. Allah will love you and forgive your faults, and Allah is forgiving, merciful. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this program. During all these programs we were together, we took great help from the book Ahlul Bayt, The Celestial Beings on the Earth, available at al-islam.org. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. دمعت عليك ظلت تنزل جروح يا
طلبوا اليمة بمصابك ذابت الروح طلب راي توفقني بخدمتك ولا تحرمني من الدمع والنور يا ابو النعمة وباب للرحمة أدري توفيقي هو أسبابه إلك أسأل وانت تتفضل من توظفني خادم ببابه
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
Dear listeners, we're going to continue our discussion of Imam Khomeini's views on different issues. In today's program, you'll be listening to his advice on the authorities and students of seminaries. Please stay with us. Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, had explicated his views on seminaries and presented necessary warnings on the issue during his lifetime. However, this issue is the most important message to the seminaries and to religious scholars of ulama in the waning months of the Imam's life. In his message, the Imam called the ulama or religious scholars as the carriers and trustees of revelation, which they should strive to guide the people through the content of revelation and what has been bequeathed to us from the Prophet of Islam and his infallible progeny, blessings of God upon them. He writes in his message, "There is no doubt that the seminaries and the committed ulama throughout the history of Islam and Shi'ism have been the most important bastion of Islam against assaults and deviations. The great religious scholars or ulama of Islam have tried through their lifetimes to promote the issues of divine haram or forbidden laws and halal or permitted laws, without modification. Had there not been the dear jurisprudence, it was not clear what sciences would have been sold to the masses in the name of sciences of the Quran, Islam, and Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them. The collection and preservation of the sciences of the Holy Quran and Islam, and the works and hadith of the great Prophet, and the practices and behavior of the infallible Imams, peace be upon them, and the registration, compilation, and explication of them under the conditions that there were very little facilities and the rulers and oppressors had employed all their facilities to destroy the works of prophethood was not an easy job. Yet, thank God, today we can see the result of those efforts in the works and books such as Kutub-e Arba'eh, the four main books of Shia seminaries, and other books of the previous and future generations in the fields of jurisprudence, philosophy, mathematics, astronomy, principles of jurisprudence, hadith, history of Islam, exegesis of the Holy Quran, literature, Irfan or Gnosticism, lexicon, and all various fields of sciences. If we do not call this much effort as jihad in the way of God, then what shall we call it? Imam Khomeini continues in his message for ulama and the seminaries. As for the scientific services of seminaries, there is too much to say to the extent that it goes beyond the scope of what can be mentioned here. Thank God the seminaries are rich and innovative from the viewpoint of sources and methods of discussion and ijtihad or independent reasoning on the basis of the Holy Quran and Hadith. I do not think that there can be found a more proper way for deep and comprehensive examination of Islamic sciences than the methods of the preceding ulama. Over 1,000 years of history of research and erudition of true ulama or religious scholars of Islam bears testimony to this claim. This has nurtured the sapling of Islam to flourish. For hundreds of years, the clergy of Islam have been the support of the deprived. The downtrodden have always been satiated by the pure kosar of the teachings of great jurisprudence. Apart from their scientific and cultural struggles, which are superior to the bloods of martyrs in some aspects, in every age, they have suffered hardships and bitterness in defense of their religion and patriotic sanctities. And, while suffering captivity, exile, prison, imprisonment, harassment, and taunts, they have offered precious martyrs to the divine court. The martyrs of the clergy are not restricted to the martyrs of struggles and the war in Iran. Certainly, the number of anonymous martyrs of seminaries and the clergy who have lost their lives in the path of spreading the divine teachings and divine laws in the hands of mercenaries is very large. In every divine and popular uprising and revolution, the ulama or religious scholars of Islam have been the first who have been martyred. Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, continued by saying, "This does not mean that we defend all clergymen, and the dependent and sanctimonious clergy were not and are not small in number. There are people in seminaries who are active against pure Muhammadian Islam. Today some people, through sanctimonious posture, are cutting the roots of religion, revolution, and the system in a way as if they had no other duty. The danger of this backwardness and regression is certainly not small. Dear students, should not neglect these colorful snakes for a single moment. These are the promoters of American Islam and the enemies of God's messengers. The late Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, points to two key methods that are used by enemies in seminaries. The Imam said, once the global arrogance was disappointed at complete destruction of the clergy and seminaries, it chose two ways to strike. One was intimidation and coercion, and the other way was deception and infiltration in the contemporary decades. When the weapon of intimidation and threatening was useless, the ways of infiltration was strengthened. The first and most important move was the insinuation of the slogan of separation of religion from politics, which has unfortunately worked to some extent in seminaries and among the clergy, so that interference in politics is considered as inferior to the status of the jurisprudent, and entering the arena of politics will cause the accusation of dependence on foreigners. For sure, the struggling clergy have been suffering more from infiltration. Do not think that the accusation of dependence and calumny of irreligiousness have been applied against the clergy only by foreigners. This is not so. The blows of unaware and dependent, aware clergy have been much stronger than those of the foreigners. Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, also addressed the clergy in his testimony. The Imam said, I recommend to the seminaries, as I have repeatedly said, that in this era that the opponents of Islam and the Islamic Republic have attempted to topple Islam and try in every way to achieve this satanic goal, one of the important ways to this unholy and dangerous end is to infiltrate deviated and wicked persons in seminaries, whose great short-term danger is to scandalize the seminaries with indecent acts and deviated ethics and methods. And the very danger in long-term is to attain high positions by one or a few charlatans who ensconce themselves among the masses and strata of pure-hearted people and make them love them, and then deal a fatal blow to the Islamic seminaries and Dear Islam and a country at the right moment. Dear listeners, in our next program, we shall continue our discussions today. Until then, goodbye and God bless.
Around the world with reporters.
Another wide-scale operation was launched by the Yemeni army against the oil giant Aramco in several areas in Saudi Arabia. The spokesman of the Yemeni army said Yemen's air force has successfully targeted Aramco's oil facilities in Ras Tanura in Dammam with 8 drones of Samad 3 type and a ballistic missile.
Our forces have targeted Aramco oil facilities in Ras Tanura in the Dammam region, eastern Saudi Arabia, with 8 Samad 3 drones and a Zulfiqar ballistic missile.
Saria also added that Aramco's facilities in Jeddah, Jazan, and Najran were also successfully hit by 5 ballistic missiles and 2 drones of Sammatri type. He then warned Riyadh against further attacks until the war on Yemen is stopped. Earlier, Saudi officials said they had intercepted ballistic missiles targeting Eastern Province as well as the cities of Najran and Jazan in the south. The attacks came in response to the years-long Saudi aggression against Yemen.
Yemen's army has no way but to intensify its attacks against Saudi Arabia amid the kingdom's aggression against the impoverished nation. Saudi Arabia uses all capabilities, targeting civilian areas in Yemen, destroying the country's infrastructures. The latest attacks by the Yemeni army serve as a tit-for-tat operation.
Saudi Arabia launched a deadly war against Yemen in March 2015, killing tens of thousands of civilians, most of them women and children, and displacing millions more.
People here hailed the Yemeni army for its retaliatory attacks on Saudi Arabia. They say Saudi Arabia will remain a legitimate target for them as long as it continues its aggression against the impoverished nation. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Across the world, the Afghan crisis continues to be a major talking point. It's no different here in the EU's de facto capital, Brussels. Members of the public have been sharing their views with Press TV.
I think they should leave the country and try for themselves to come out of it.
We should not intervene sometimes in proposing democracy or the sorts of political situations where they're not in, when the country is not ready.
Especially the United States deals in this country. It makes it worse, I think.
Now they are taking all of the materials, but I think as a global community we should interfere, but to stop that.
Power and interference always go together.
Anti-war campaigners are furious at remarks made by EU Foreign Policy Chief Joseph Borrell last Thursday. He said Afghanistan proves the need for an expanded EU military force, more commonly referred to as the EU Army.
We have to step up our integrated approach, combining military, civilian, development and diplomatic efforts.
We have been speaking to citizens about Afghans who are desperate to seek asylum. EU leaders, they don't want more refugees. Do you think we should take more refugees in?
Yes, he needs. He needs to take more refugees because these people is in bad situation in their country.
Belgian people or European people say that we don't have enough place, but I think we have.
We must take refugees because all the people are on the same world. We are the same world.
They need to offer that help, and I believe that they need to offer a place to stay because they have nowhere else to stay.
The policy of occupying nations against their will certainly didn't go well in Afghanistan. Top EU officials and also prime ministers in the 27-country bloc are saying lessons must be learned. A good start, critics argue, would be for the EU to stop responding how high when Washington shouts, jump. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Among the 7 Iranian COVID vaccines, Covfars is making a name for itself. Developed by Razi Serum and Vaccine Research Institute, the recombinant vaccine started the third human trial phase on Sunday.
In this phase, we are going to have 40,000 people in 2 groups, one receiving Sinopharm and the other Razi Covfars. We are going to compare the number of people who are going to get sick in each group, and by comparing with each other, what we are hoping to show is that the efficacy of our vaccine is at least the same as the Sinopharm.
Iran has so far vaccinated roughly 10% of its population. This as the resurgence of the coronavirus in more lethal forms, like the Delta variant, has been killing an average of around 500 Iranians every day in the past month. As the government is scrambling to import more vaccines, Covfars authorities say they're working to get an emergency use license to help speed up the inoculation program.
Given the restrictions imposed by U.S. sanctions on the way of vaccine imports to Iran, we need to boost our domestic production of COVID vaccines. So we are expecting that Cove Parks will get the emergency use license halfway through the third trial stage.
Cove Parks is administered in three doses, two intramuscular shots 21 days apart, and one intranasal shot 1 month after the second dose. Cove Parks says if all goes based on the plan, the vaccine will hit the market in 6 months.
As the coronavirus keeps transforming into wilder variants, Cove Parks developers say they've already launched their production line to speed up the vaccination process. The biotech firm says as soon as it gets the emergency use license, it will kick off mass production with a capacity of 3 million doses per month. Yusuf Jalali, Alborz Province.
Taliban have deployed more troops and military hardware to the northeastern Panjshir Valley to take the last remaining territory in Afghanistan from the National Resistance Front, headed by Ahmed Massoud, the son of Afghanistan's national hero, Ahmad Shah Massoud. Massoud has called for a negotiated settlement with the Taliban, but has said his forces will resist if the narrow and mountainous valley is attacked. Meanwhile, some top political leaders urge both sides to set aside differences and resume a meaningful negotiation in a bid to avoid dangerous scenarios, mainly the loss of civilian lives in Panjshir, as well as a spread of armed resistance across the rest of provinces.
The only way of the ongoing situation in Panjshir is to simultaneously resume meaningful negotiations and continue resistance against any totalitarian policy to pave the way for establishment of an inclusive government.
This is while the expansion of war has forced hundreds of local villagers to flee their houses. They call on the international community and especially the UN to convince both sides to resume negotiations.
The war has forced us to flee our village and come to Kabul. I have 5 children. We have nowhere to go but city parks. We want peace. Our children should take up their education in a calm atmosphere. So I want Massoud and Taliban to stop their war machines.
The possible fall of Panjshir Valley into the hands of Taliban will bring the entire country under the rule of Taliban for the first time, as they couldn't capture Panjshir Valley during their first rule in Afghanistan before their collapse in 2001.
The war on Panjshir has turned into a big headache for the Taliban. Moreover, the group's leaders have so far failed to reach an agreement on the formation of the new government in Kabul. The Taliban have postponed the move again, saying they need more time for final consultations among the group's top leaders. Syed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
A high-level Lebanese ministerial and security delegation has arrived in Damascus. Deputy Prime Minister of the Lebanese caretaker government, Zain Akkar, who holds several other positions, headed the delegation, which included the ministers of energy and finance, as well as head of the General Directorate of General Security. They were welcomed by Syria's foreign minister at the Jdeidet Yabus crossing. The delegation held talks with several Syrian officials at once at the foreign ministry, namely the Syrian ministers of foreign affairs, finance, and oil. Talks focused on economic cooperation and Lebanon's need of Syria's help in transferring gas for generating electricity.
The two sides discussed the difficult circumstances they are living in, especially the electricity and gas sectors. The Lebanese side asked Syria to help Lebanon in transferring Egyptian gas and Jordanian electricity through Syrian territories. The Syrian side welcomed our request and expressed Syria's readiness to assist.
Both sides agreed to follow up the technical aspects and details of implementation through a joint technical team. Observers believe such a visit was only possible due to the U.S. backing of a plan that ensures Lebanon obtains gas.
I think Lebanon got a green light from the U.S. for such a visit. The Syrian government conveyed a message to the Lebanese side that it has accepted their request. I think the matter now is in the hands of Lebanon to get a regional and international approval for Syria's participation in pumping gas to Lebanon, as there are U.S. and EU economic sanctions on Syria.
Lebanon is seeking to revive a 2009 deal which stipulated that Egypt transfers millions of cubic meters of gas annually to Syria through Jordan, while Syria pumps the same amount to Lebanon. This is Lebanese officials' most significant visit to Syria since the start of the crisis in 2011. Lebanon, which remained relatively neutral towards Syria for so long, seems to have no other option now in light of its economic slowdown but to fully reactivate its cooperation and relations with Syria in hopes of some economic relief. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
Streets remain deserted and business establishments closed in all major towns and the capital city of Indian-administered Kashmir for the second day after the death of the region's veteran separatist leader, Syed Ali Gilani. Indian forces continued a strong presence to prevent anti-government protests and enforce a strict lockdown. The authorities had also imposed near-total communication blockade across Kashmir as a precautionary measure to maintain law and order. On Friday, additional deployments were made to prevent people from holding anti-government protests after the Friday prayers.
Gilani, the most powerful separatist leader in Kashmir who spent many years in different jails, died on Wednesday evening at his Srinagar residence, where he had remained incarcerated